Good afternoon. This is session 501, Sex, Lies, and Audio Tapes, documenting fallen politicians. So if anybody is in the wrong session, now's the time to leave, because this is not for the faint of heart. My name is Eunice DiBella, and I am the Public Records Administrator for the State of Connecticut. In this role, I have overall responsibility for the state archives as well as public records programs for state and local government records, and I will be serving as moderator for this session. Today, we will cover the issues that surround the management of archives and records that are the product of a corrupt political environment. These case studies cover three levels of government: local, state, and officials who were elected to Congress and the Senate. We will discuss the problems of working as an archivist in this troubled environment. What are the challenges of collecting, processing, and providing access to these documents? And of course, these questions apply to the entire body of government records as well. Our speakers today are Dr. Molly Keller. Molly is the archivist and records manager for the City of Bridgeport, Connecticut. She represents the archives community on the Connecticut State Library Board, of which she is currently the chair. A historian by training and profession, she has an AB degree from Mount Holyoke College and holds a PhD from New York University. She has been a consultant to the United States Army Chaplain Corps and the Real Estate Board of New York, and has written books for young adults as well as more traditional scholarly articles. Molly is deputy coordinator of the Connecticut State Historical Records Advisory Board and has worked with me on many municipal records projects and issues. The title of her talk is Bridgeport Before and After the Fall. I will be reading the second paper of our panel. Mark Jones, archivist of the State of Connecticut, who unfortunately cannot be with us today, received his PhD degree in early American history from Northern Illinois University in DeKalb. He began his archival career at the Illinois Regional Depository System and worked in records management programs in Iowa and New York State. He has served as Connecticut State Archivist since 1982, and his paper is entitled The Song of Roland. Betsy Pittman is university archivist and curator for political and Connecticut history collections at the Thomas J. Dodd Research Center of the University of Connecticut. Betsy received her BA degree in history from William Smith College and her MA and MLS degree in European History and Archives from the University of Maryland. And the title of Betsy's talk is Negotiating the Restricted Collections. We're going to begin our program with Molly Keller. All three papers will be delivered, and then we will be available for questions. Thank you.
Good afternoon. For those of you hoping for some juicy stuff that's hinted at in the title of this session, I should explain that the idea for this exposition was rather flippantly cooked up by Eunice, Mark Jones, and me last year during the Nagara meeting. We were having such a good time, we were trying to figure out how we could get back to the next meeting. We figured that we could capitalize on the political corruption that seems to be our state's growth industry while addressing a legitimate, albeit ugly, aspect of government records management. We chose the title deliberately to titillate. The lies referred to all of those "I am not a crook" type statements heard everywhere these days, it seems. The audio tape refers to the bugs and wiretaps the FBI used to catch the former mayor of Bridgeport and perhaps other people you may know. And the sex, well, that unfortunately refers to the former mayor of Waterbury, whose crimes were so heinous that no one even knows where he's incarcerated. And then we realized that maybe this wasn't such a jokey idea. I'm going to talk to you this afternoon about record keeping in a highly politicized municipality. I will fill you in on the history and culture of government in Bridgeport, Connecticut, describe the various problems created and issues raised by the impact of political malfeasance on government record keeping, and consider how and if things could have been different. I hope this will open a conversation among those of us laboring at the local level and perhaps help us establish a more authentic and usable paradigm of local government records management. Bridgeport is a once wealthy, now down on its luck industrial town about 60 miles north of New York City on the north shore of that American Mediterranean known as Long Island Sound. The city was incorporated out of the neighboring colonial towns of Stratford and Fairfield in 1836. With the strategic use of municipal bonds and the fortuitous use of that most venerable of urban development tools, fire, the city became a 19th century transportation hub. It attracted the tracks of the fledgling Housatonic Railroad, connecting it with western Massachusetts and the nearby riches of upstate New York in 1840, and the Naugatuck Railroad, which brought down the goods, produce, and brass buttons from Waterbury in 1848. The main line of the New York, New Haven, and Hartford Railroad to Boston came through town in 1849. The rights of way for these tracks had been cleared by a spectacularly convenient conflagration in December of 1845. Bridgeport was home to Singer Sewing Machine and Remington Arms and Warner Corsets. Good transportation and a critical mass of skilled machinists spawned other factories, great and small. It was called the Arsenal of Democracy during the First World War for all its munitions plants, including one that was commissioned by Tsar Nicholas II in 1915. But as industry moved out and faded during the 20th century, that sobriquet was no longer apropos. For many years, the giant factory building stood vacant, and only now, in, of course, the era of stringent EPA rules, are they being knocked down, remediated, and offered for reuse. Bridgeport was also, for many years, the home of P.T. Barnum, who, having served as mayor in 1876, concluded that Bridgeport would not have good government until it had enjoyed a few first-class funerals. In the 1920s, mayors used their special knowledge of urban development plans to parcel out individual tax abatements, bringing the state's first financial oversight board to our borders. From 1933 to 1957, Bridgeport enjoyed the rule of the Socialist Party under one Jasper McLevy. And after him, the Democrats took control. Bridgeport became virtually a one-party town. This turned out to be advantageous to some politicians who speculated in land and contracts, especially as the Connecticut Thruway came through. In fact, the very existence of the records program in this city is due to a mayor who, while never actually indicted himself, saw 15 of his friends and allies off to the pokey, and who decided upon leaving office to have Public Works come and remove all his papers from City Hall. For safekeeping, you understand, in the municipal incinerator. And so, boom, in less than a year, his successor had created this program and my job. This romp through Bridgeport's past is to give you a wee taste of its political culture, a culture that truly blossomed during the tenure of Joseph P. Ganim, who ran the city from 1991 to 2003. You shall now hear of his hopeful arrival, his lamentable corruption, his pitiable downfall, and the mess we civil servants are still trying to sort out, while all of us here in this room today subsidize through our taxes his stay at the Fort Dix Federal Correctional Facility. When Joe Ganim swept into office in 1991, having handily defeated the incumbent Republican mayoress who had tried to cure the city's financial ills by declaring its bankruptcy, it was as if the Kennedys had come to town. Short, dark, and handsome in a boyish sort of way, he was surrounded and supported by a large family of lawyers. and he was enthusiastically embraced by the city's predominant Democratic Party, even though shortly before the election he had been a Republican. Ghanem, it seems, could fill Democratic coffers as no one had ever done before. The new mayor talked sincerely about sensible and seemingly practical ways of getting the city going again. And shortly after his swearing in, he married a blue-eyed blonde and soon had the perfect political family of one boy and one girl. What wasn't to love? And actually, for a while, things did improve in Bridgeport. New personnel cleaned up financial and accounting practices enough to give the city an almost respectable bond rating, and the state-run Financial Review Board, which had been overseeing the city's finances since 1988, felt comfortable enough to fold up its tent and leave within 5 years of Ghanem's taking office. The mayor wisely understood the importance of keeping up appearances and used grant funds to plant trees and flowers, clean up trash-filled lots, and replace old street lamps with decorative ersatz electrified gas lamps, and the cracked concrete pavements with brick sidewalks. All of these touches made the suburbanites who ventured downtown to the city's hospitals and courthouses, which is the only reason anyone goes downtown, feel that Bridgeport was a great place to be. He imported a new police chief and boasted of the drop in crime. He attracted new small businesses to the city, and he converted brown fields into ball fields. Active in the U.S. Council of Mayors, Ghanem was soon nationally cited as an up-and-coming young statesman. So confident was he and his party of his talent and fundraising potential that he even made a run at unseating Governor Rowland, of whom you shall hear shortly. But soon the snake started whispering to this latter-day Adam. Ghanem began believing his own press. Or, as a friend of mine put it, hubris is a word too little appreciated these days. At some point, probably in 1995 or 96, a light bulb went on in the heads of Ghanem and his closest advisors. This was basically the same light that Jack Abramoff knows how to switch on and off so well, the one that powers public and private prosperity at the same time. There was gold in city business, money to be earned from granting contracts and hiring consultants, luxurious gifts from grateful vendors and employees. Thank you. To be enjoyed. Power and influence to be harnessed and sold. For the next 5 years, the administration routinely demanded and divided kickbacks from contracts, privatized certain city functions, earned consulting and signing fees, took all expense-paid trips to exotic locales. My personal favorite was when the mayor and a few of his friends flew to Japan to study the bullet trains, which are oh so likely to happen on Amtrak's Northeast Corridor. Sad but true. Played fast and loose with employees and labor agreements and reassigned certain public expenses to private pension benefits. Having rebuilt and redecorated the mayoral offices at City Hall for several hundred thousand dollars, Ghanem moved the executive branch into a new City Hall, taking for himself the gilded offices of a former bank president. To this day, Bridgeport, which can barely manage its own budget, supports three city halls. It had become an imperial mayoralty. We no longer worked in Camelot, but in Boss Tweed's courthouse. And of course, at the same time, the records environment changed too. Now, Bridgeport has had an active records management program since 1983, created by ordinance, set up and run according to best industry practices. It has a governing commission of city and public members, although it hasn't met since 1994. It provides for an archivist and a records manager, now one and the same, and speaking to you, and even has a record center. It's underground and has a perpetual sump pump, which often dies in the middle of rainstorms, but we have storage space nonetheless. One of the first tasks the infant department tackled was scheduling mayoral records. In 1983 and 84, a consulting certified records manager analyzed and weeded the records and then proposed and implemented an elegant functional filing and retention system that was logical and easy to follow. Other departments were surveyed and scheduled later, and pretty soon we had a good organization that created, collected, and destroyed its records efficiently. But then came another fiscal crisis and budget cuts and layoffs. The Department of Archives and Records shrank to one woman, and the other city departments, similarly ravaged, could spare no one to look after their own records. I'm sure nothing like this has ever happened in any of your shops. By the time of the ill-fated bankruptcy attempt in 1990, the city's records program had retreated to its essential core, which is pretty much where it remains today. Into this retrenchment rode Mayor Ganim, a lawyer, and the mayoral files already strained by 2 years of office help, who could not get things into the right folders no matter how many notes and hints were written in red across the top of the documents, fell apart. Soon after the inauguration, the mayor's chief of staff, who was his college roommate and a professional photographer, called me in for a conference about what he called matters archival. My heart went pity-pat. Armed with the blueprint for the system, I was looking forward to a good file clean-out and clean-up, and I confess, a little push for the city records program from the top. The mayor, however, only wanted to redecorate his office by sending 10 filing cabinets intact to the record center. They didn't need the old stuff, they said, and they could handle everything else in loose leaf notebooks and red wall files. At least, I protested, let me box up what's in the cabinets. No comment. No further admittance to the sanctum sanctorum. And 3 months later, I opened my office door one morning to find 3 hand carts piled up with broken boxes of paper and loose pen deflex hangers from guess where. At least I didn't get the cabinets. Despite my repeated overtures and entreaties, including an ill-fated plan to have one copy of every lease, contract, and agreement the mayor signed sent to the archive so that we could always locate a document when we needed it, I was never again in the mayor's office until the day he resigned. The systematic creation and collection of the chief executive's files was not the only casualty of the Ganim administration. Another was the loss of the oath book, you know, that official paper you sign when you've been sworn in to municipal office. In Bridgeport, this is kept by the city clerk on behalf of the city council, which is supposed to approve all appointments. The mayor decided it would be more convenient to keep it locked up in his suite. To this day, complains our clerk, we're still not sure who is officially on certain boards and commissions because names were entered and attested to in such a random way. This mayor couldn't figure out where to sign our state records disposal forms either, and often usurped the space for the public records administrator or state archivist, despite my highlighting and the yellow sticky sign here notes. Maybe this was because they sign at the bottom of the page, which is where the more important people get to sign. As the Ganim years rolled on, and the heads of certain departments and other people too began to roll, we also witnessed the creation of the shadow files, those CYA copies you make and keep in a safe place, often with another backup set at home, and maybe even in your car, in case someone tries to fire you or frame you. It was about this time that we also stopped making jokes about cement shoes. These documents swelled exponentially as the administration began granting most favored nation status to a few select contractors, as civil servants began objecting to patently falsified invoices presented for payment, and as some intransigent and uncooperative employees were mugged in the parking lot. I mention this just because it was coincidence, not implying causality, you understand. One document I know just about everyone in City Hall had a copy of, rubbed their hands over, was an apparently routine end-of-year budget transfer request. It was labeled as a request from the harbor master for new uniforms, but deep inside it held an $800,000 transfer from the employees' pension fund to a $2.6 million insurance policy and annuity for the mayor and certain cabinet members. Eventually, thank goodness, the press got hold of it too, and after much huffling and shuffling, the policy seems to have been canceled, although we've never gotten the papers turned in from certain members of that cabinet. Another records calamity was total confusion. Suddenly, departments that had had working systems for years forgot their priorities and began to create elaborate and multicolored schemes to file trivia, but that had no means of keeping track of proposals, bids, contracts, or other big-ticket items, like the sewers. Bridgeport privatized its wastewater system in 1996 and granted that company an 18-year extension in 1999, but to this day we have not found the winning proposal, although we have extensive documentation from the failed suitors. This collapse was accompanied by the arbitrary declassification of certain records into non-records. The most famous instance was in response to a Freedom of Information request from the newspaper for the details of the mayor's cell phone records. The city attorney at first offered redacted copies and then changed his mind, and when challenged, declared that it was the bill that was the record, not the calling list, and that the city was therefore under no obligation to produce them for the public. And besides, all those people the mayor was talking to had a reasonable expectation of privacy that would be violated by full disclosure. The city, by the way, lost that argument and was chided by the FOI Commission for its speciousness. A final records trend in Bridgeport during the not-so-gay 90s was fear of disposal. No one wanted to destroy anything, even records well past our generous local sell-by date. For example, the state retention period for most financial documents is 3 years. In Bridgeport, it's 10. This was the rampant just-in-case era, the time of you never know. Despite my warnings that these records could come back to bite them, very few city officials signed off on anything. And indeed, the records did bite back. Now it wasn't just FOI requests, but subpoenas from a federal grand jury. We may never know who or what set things off, or if the FBI was just routinely keeping an eye on Bridgeport. But as the millennium approached, I began to get more and more requests for all the invoices for a particular vendor, or all the checks issued to one particular company, or all the detail sheets of the executive credit cards. Besides using city records, of course, the FBI was working its own magic. It planted bugs in a local diner and caught the conversations of the mayor's preferred developers about the dollar a square foot they sent the mayor, conversations that had those principals pleading guilty and plea bargaining. It tapped cell phones and caused the mayor's closest aides to also cop pleas. As the evidence and testimony about kickbacks, Lucullan extravagances, plotting and scheming piled up all around him, the mayor insisted he had done nothing, nothing at all to betray the city he served. He was indicted on Halloween of 2001. Who says the feds don't have a sense of humor? On 24 charges of racketeering, extortion, conspiracy, mail fraud, and tax fraud. 5 days later, he assured city employees by email that he had been betrayed by those he trusted. He maintained this line throughout his trial and even made jokes from the witness stand. His conviction on 16 of those charges must have come as quite a jolt to him. Joe Ganim is now a model prisoner in New Jersey. Recently, he was joined there by a former city councilman and state senator who admitted taking bribes to steer contracts to his friends and relations. And although the current mayor of Bridgeport, who had been city council president through all this, insists that you don't have to pay to play in Bridgeport, and although the director of economic development, to prove that we're so squeaky clean, routinely hands out cards for the local FBI office to potential vendors in case they want to complain, Uncle Sam's agents, like Detective Columbo, keep coming back for just one more thing. And then there are the collateral damages, like people suing the city for insults incurred during the Ganem years. The biggest is from a former developer of the city's largest waterfront parcel, who claims the city abrogated its contract with him in favor of that dollar-a-square-foot firm. Discovery in this case is wide-reaching and ongoing. Departments have been asked to provide evidence of any contract, however informal, written or oral, with the developers, attorneys, architects, or publicists that Ganem preferred. A memo from the city attorney says that evidence in this case includes, but is by no means limited to, a paper file, a ledger, a written contract, a grant application, a purchase order, a city check, a budget, an audit report, or an electronic file. But since filing here went to hell, it is hell to find what the attorneys are looking for. And chastened by recent court rulings that records may not be destroyed when there is even an expectation of a lawsuit, the city of Bridgeport is now not destroying anything. This is perhaps the most frustrating result of municipal corruption. Not only do we lose revenue, redevelopment, and reputation, but everything stops in its wake. Records stack up in offices because there's no more room in the record center. Untold hours are spent locating documents that, because of the records breakdown I've described, are misclassified, misfiled, or just plain missing. That's the nightmare he created, says our city clerk. He did all these things, and now we're looking for things, and they're just not there. The Bridgeport Records Program is still limping along and serving most of its constituents as well as ever. The application of more money, now as then, would help, of course. To strengthen our efforts, we, and here I'm using the editorial we because I'm still the whole department, are starting to pull together a policy on legislative holds to re-educate record keepers on how to identify potentially important documents, to reinforce the urgency of proper and timely filing and disposal procedures. But I think this scandal or crisis or possibly just an episode is part of a bigger set of issues. We can document only so much. We can create and preserve only so much. We cannot, however, solve the bigger problems of municipal records management. One of these problems is that local government is essentially an amateur enterprise. People come in and out of office every 2 years with usually nothing but party loyalty and a checkbook to recommend them. Patronage jobs do not require quite the same skill sets as the civil service ones. Consequently, we are constantly training new administrators, many of whom have no background in any sort of management, and who will argue with great conviction that all records should be kept 7 years or forever on a CD. You should know that just a month ago, our current chief administrative officer told me that microfilm was obsolete. Another problem is the enduring perception that the care and feeding of records is menial and meaningless and dirty. No matter how well I dress, my record center, after all, is in a sub-basement with a sump pump. Not exactly a glamorous location. No one volunteers to be a department's records liaison, so the job gets assigned to the person with the least seniority in an office, and one who therefore knows the least about how it works. Often, it's a high school kid who's come in for the afternoon. No one owns the records anymore, or cares very much about them, until they have spilled over into the aisles or the kitchenette of the office. A third problem is lack of enforcement power. You really can't make these horses drink. I can set systems up, explain them, encourage their use, but that's still no guarantee that a second non-system will not spring up in the night, if that office files anything at all. Most people, as you probably know, would rather go to the dentist than open a filing cabinet. Julian Mims, writing on the RIM professionalism in a political arena for the March-April of 2006 Information Management Journal, paints a glowing and optimistic picture of local government records management. Among the usual nostrums he dispenses about finding strong allies for your department, promoting the program, reducing costs, blah, 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 he does slip in two important observations. One is that human relations are paramount in government programs. Nothing works better than personal contact. This is true, but one person can't be everywhere. The other is that the politically charged environment can undercut individual effort and well-being, and interpersonal relationships may become strained. Certainly, we internalized that understatement while trying to document the Ghanem years. But to those observations, I would like to add a third, that fear and paranoia, those fellow travelers of political corruption, are excellent destroyers of order and of records programs. I grew up on Long Island, New York, in a burgeoning suburban melting pot. To me, Connecticut seemed glamorous and classy, populated by rich, white, Christian, unhyphenated Americans. Everybody must have been related to Katharine Hepburn. I knew this from the movies I watched and from the fact that the New Haven Railroad cars had blue velvet seats, while those of us condemned to the Long Island Railroad had to make do with red or blue leatherette. Then we moved to Connecticut, and I got to see beyond those terminally cute village greens presided over by white churches and their congregants to the vicious politics of local government, to the presence of the mob, even here, and to the scandals and inefficiencies in every town. And when I came to work for a Connecticut government, the last scales fell from my eyes, and my congenitally cynical soul was vindicated. For now I could watch up close the maneuvering, the playing, the posturing, the promising, and the reneging firsthand. I got to meet the movers and the shakers, and perhaps more importantly, how they were related to each other. In Bridgeport, where genealogical charts are often more important than organizational charts, it is very helpful to know who is whose cousin. I got to learn how to protect my program and my job. And now I think, Catherine who? I had originally intended this paper to be a case study, but I suspect that many of you have encountered similar frustrations and roadblocks. And in that spirit, I hope this screed will begin a discussion with you of what realistically can be done. So, can we talk? Thank you.
Well, now I have to change hats, and I am your second speaker. Thank you very much, Molly. I'm going to talk about a similar situation, but at a higher level, and that is the term of Governor John Rowland and the fallout in regard to the management of his records. On June 21st, 2004, at 6 p.m., three-term Governor John G. Rowland stood before TV cameras and reporters in front of the governor's mansion and in a 45-second speech told voters that he would resign as Connecticut's 86th governor at 12 noon on July 1st. He did not mention the federal investigation underway into bid rigging in his administration, nor the public hearings of the impeachment committee that gave details of illegal gifts he had taken from contractors doing business with the state. He did not apologize for his crimes, but acknowledged that his, quote, bad judgment had brought us here,
His wife, Patricia, stood by his side. At the end of the talk, the couple turned and walked back to the entrance of the residence, hand in hand. It made quite a picture, I might say. It was high tragedy on the tube in everyone's home. It was also a momentous occasion in Connecticut political and constitutional history. The circumstances surrounding his departure are unique in Connecticut history. He took this step after the state Supreme Court had decided that a sitting governor must honor a subpoena to testify before the select committee of the House known as the Impeachment Committee. After this decision, Roland's options were very limited. If the governor had invoked the Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination, where the committee, he risked a report from the committee to the whole House recommending his impeachment. If he talked, more information about the crooked dealings in his administration come out. However, Governor Roland nipped this conundrum in the bud. He resigned from office and a few weeks later pled guilty in federal court to one count of corruption in office. The scandal that had begun with his lie that he alone, not his staff, had purchased a hot tub for his cottage at Bantam Lake ended in the downfall of one of the most popular Connecticut politicians in recent decades. The next governor would be Lieutenant Governor M. Jody Rell. But who was she? In spite of having been Roland's running mate in three elections, most voters did not know her. As the scandal grew, she had prudently distanced herself from the governor. The press, politicians from both parties, and even John Roland had assured voters that she was up to the job. Her inaugural speech would be one of the most important ever given by a Connecticut governor. Would she gain people's confidence in her? On July 1st, in front of the north side of the state capitol, Jody Rell took the oath of office and gave the speech. Her rhetoric was simple, tough, and direct. She pledged that anyone in her administration entrusted with public office would uphold the highest standard of public integrity and ethical principles. "We must and we will," she declared, "recommit ourselves to ending the culture of corruption that has plagued our state for far too long." Opinion polls soared, and the public's high opinion of her has never ebbed. The transfer of power was peaceful and orderly. Behind the scenes, however, the Connecticut State Library was working as fast as we could to see that the transfer of Governor Roland's records would be equally successful. In addition, since the work of the impeachment committee in all practically ceased on July 1st at 12 noon, the State Library was also interested in the transfer of these records. A public act had directed the committee to send the records of its work and proceedings to the State Library. This presentation will summarize the highlights of the journeys of both collections of records and what has been done with them and what needs to be done. I would like to acknowledge the invaluable assistance of archivist Paul Barron in preparing this talk. Paul is the principal archivist involved in accessioning and processing Governor Roland's records, as well as the records of the House Select Committee of Inquiry. For most of the 20th century, the Office of the Governor has regularly transferred records to the State Library. In 2001, Mark Jones met with Governor Roland's in Governor Roland's office with a staff attorney and another Roland official to discuss the governor's records. The reason for this meeting was that additional space was needed in the state capitol where the governor's records were stored. Governor Roland was running out of space, and they really wanted to clean out the state capitol. At that time, Mark was able to inspect and survey the files. Primarily, what he saw were constituent files and files of the chief of staff. He was given a thick inventory of boxes in a three-ring binder. I mean, it was quite an impressive inventory. After his tour, he spoke to the attorney, talking about the importance of gubernatorial files for research into Connecticut history. Although the State Archives has a standing guideline that we don't take in records while the governor is actually in office, in this particular instance, we were very happy to entertain this proposal. We would have agreed, of course, to accession these files. However, after the meeting, very little happened, and in fact, no chief of staff records were transferred to the State Library. And from what I understand, we only got a couple of boxes of proclamations. After our meeting with the officials in the Rowland administration, we got some rather interesting inquiries from their office. And the chief question that we got was, if these records were actually transferred to the State Library, would we have to make them available to the public? In other words, they were interested in transferring them, but it appeared as though they didn't want anybody to see them, which we thought was quite strange. Of course, we had to inform the governor's office that the governor's records fall under FOI statute. There are no special statutes that cover governor's records or give them any particular executive privilege. And so that was the end of that discussion. Later, the governor's office asked Mark and me to approve a disposal request for some of these files. So in other words, they wanted to free up space. They thought about transferring them, but they really didn't want anybody to see them. So the next, I guess, plan was to see if we could get them to let them destroy them. So, of course, according to our retention schedule, these records are permanent. So our answer was no. However, this begged the question, and we asked ourselves, what is in these records? Almost 6 months before Rowland resigned, his political star descended so precipitously that people were, you know, beginning to bet on the date of his departure. Various allegations were beginning to surface, not only about himself, but about the people around him, including the discovery that one of his former chiefs of staff had buried gold in his backyard. In December 2003, a reporter for the New Haven Advocate called the State Library and inquired of the State Archivist as to whether or not the governor would turn over to the State Archives his records if he were to resign. So there was some anticipation about this occurring. The case of former Vermont Governor Howard Dean's claim of executive privilege closing his records was fresh in the reporter's mind, and he said, would John Rowland hide under executive privilege, she asked. And of course, as I've already mentioned, we have no such executive privilege in the state of Connecticut for gubernatorial records. So let's now fast forward to the summer of 2004. After the governor announced that he would resign, his staff had only 2 weeks to clear out their offices. In an attempt to get a handle on what would happen to the records, the state librarian, myself, the public records administrator, and the state archivist met with Rowland's last chief of staff. And we were asked to help the orderly transfer of these files from the state capitol over to the state library. Finally, we were going to get the records that we had been looking for. Given the speed with which events were cascading, we assumed that the new governor and not the departing one would make decisions regarding the disposition of Governor Rowland's records. In the fall of 2004, Governor Rell's fiscal office called the state library to report that she had been given the job of transferring records to the state archives. In the governor's office, there was an urgency on account of the need for space. By the end of December, the state archives had acquired between 450 and 500 cubic feet of records and about 190 mementos and gifts. This was not the only accession, and the state archives continues to acquire files from the tenure of John Rowland. In the past year, we have accessioned an additional 92 cubic feet of records. And the reason that these records are coming over in a somewhat sporadic fashion is because even though Governor Rowland resigned, was indicted, and sent to prison, the investigation was still going on because there were a number of other members of his administration that were under investigation and were also sent to prison. So right now we think that we have the majority of Governor Rowland's records, but we're not really sure. It's probable that additional records will be coming over because we still have not accessioned the full complement of the Chief of Staff's files, which are extremely important. In addition to the the whole question of accessioning these records, we also have questions of access to these files. When the records came in, what we did was we looked through the records, and there were the numerous files that came through, and we redacted all of the files for Social Security numbers. There are an awful lot of constituent correspondence and things that have Social Security numbers that may be attached to them. We took the original records and we closed them, and we make the redacted records available to the public. However, as far as I know, and in my conversations with Paul Barron, the only requests that we have gotten to date to see these records have been actually from the governor's office themselves. So we technically have them closed for processing, but at some time in the near future, we will have to face the issue of opening them up and dealing with the confidentiality issues. Right now, we're concerned about certain issues that deal with constituent files. If anybody is familiar with gubernatorial records, governors get an awful lot of correspondence from their constituents. And very often, the constituents are very forthcoming with information that is considered to be privileged. For example, you might get a letter from somebody saying, I'm a resident, or I am a patient at a certain mental institution, and my condition is such and such, and my Social Security number is such and such, and I need help getting a certain type of help. That might be an example where we have a constituent file that is not considered to be a public record, that is open to disclosure. Now, it would be impossible for us to go through all of those files and to identify all of this information. So what we have traditionally done is give researchers forms to say that they would adhere to confidentiality in any records that they find. But now, because of the whole publicity and situation regarding the Rowland records, we have drafted a letter that we've sent over to the Attorney General's office, and we've asked for an updated ruling to see if this policy is sufficient for us. So that's what we're dealing with. The records have been processed to a certain extent. That is to say, we have container listings for these files, but to date, we still do not have a finding aid, but we hope that we will sometime in the future, and I can't really say when, but I'm hopeful that it won't be after too long. I want to go on and talk about some of the records of the House Committee of Inquiry. John Rowland, as I said, began sliding down the slippery slope of corruption and falsehood in late 2003. A newspaper article speculated about who paid for renovations to his cottage on Bantam Lake in Litchfield, Connecticut. Rowland denied that he had benefited from free work and insisted that his wife and he had paid for all the renovations. Further news stories suggested that work was done for free or that contractors received their payment years after the work was done. And there was the infamous hot tub that we've already mentioned. Although Rowland denied that it was a gift from a member of his own staff, word circulated that it was and that on several occasions staff had given either gifts or things or cash. On December 12, 2003, the governor admitted he had given the press, quote, inaccurate and incomplete information about the renovations. Indeed, he confessed friends, staff, state employees, state contractors had paid for the work or provided it at no cost. The governor coupled his admission that he had told a lie with a request for forgiveness. But the Connecticut electorate was fed up. The press made additional disclosures of gifts from contractors and other shady deals the daily staple of front page stories and primetime newscasts. In fact, if you were reading the Connecticut newspapers during that time, that was really on the front page almost every day. Stories circulated that federal prosecutors were also interested in the potential crimes committed by the governor and his staff, including his chief of staff, Peter Eliff. As more allegations and alleged evidence appeared in the press, Speaker of the House, Maura Lyons, revealed that the House of Representatives would assemble a bipartisan committee to investigate the allegations and make a recommendation to the House that the governor should or should not be impeached. On January 26, 2004, the House passed Resolution 702, creating a select committee of inquiry. Republicans and Democrats served on the committee. This resolution set a date for recommendation of April 14, 2004. It is important to note that the impeachment committee or select committee did not have much time to subpoena records from the office of the governor and state agencies. Furthermore, not everyone who received subpoenas cooperated, including Governor Rowland. Needless to say, the committee needed two extensions of its deadline in order to gather the evidence and distill it into an agenda for depositions and public hearings. In June 2004, the committee began public hearings, and while these were underway, the governor announced that he would resign. Further hearings or investigations ground to a halt, and on June 26, the committee issued the final report. 2 days later, two unit heads from the State Library and the State Archivist met with counsels from both the House Republicans and the House Democrats. After all, the Assembly had passed Public Act 0437, providing that any document, recorded data, information, or other tangible materials of any kind, prepared, received, owned, etc., shall be delivered to the State Library for preservation and archiving. Lucky us. Immediately, we learned that the lawyers were only too happy to turn over thousands of pieces of paper that were in the custody of the committee. These records were copies of original files in the custody of Mr. and Mrs. Rowland, the Office of the Governor, and state agencies. They came to the committee as the result of 140 document subpoenas. According to the final report, the committee received approximately 409,000 pages of documents. The Office of the Governor produced 98,000 Governor Rowland, 3,100, and state agencies went out with 220,000 pieces of paper. How did the committee manage this mountain of paper? And what would it give to the state library? We were certainly interested in knowing that. This is a complicated story, but we will try to be concise about it. The committee retained a New York City law firm and sent it boxes of the photocopied pages by the subpoenaed parties. And what they actually did was they digitized these records and then they sent the paper back to Hartford. When they digitized these records, the law firm did not create any sort of index to these records, but what they did was they assigned a Bates ID number. And we were going to get these paper records as our preservation copy, and we were a little concerned because we didn't feel we had an adequate finding aid, but I have been told by Paul Barron that this number, this Bates ID number, can be used to locate the originals. However, in addition to digitizing the records, the law firm also redacted these records. So what we have, they used some thesaurus, I guess, of had people go through them looking for certain things. I can't exactly say what they are because I don't know, and redact those things and then create basically a digitized copy in redacted form. And that was basically what we were getting. We were getting both a digitized form, digitized redacted copy, and also the original records. Now, the House committee, the House actually wanted us to destroy the original records. And once again, we were faced with a conundrum. If the pages were destroyed, someone looking for the original page could charge us, the state library, with having approved the destruction of valuable records. But if the library accessioned these multitudes of boxes, 409,000 documents, how would it provide access to the hard copy? Well, to date, we have received 315 cubic feet of the copies that were digitized, contract files, subpoena files, video depositions, and the DVDs of the public hearings. We haven't really resolved the issue of how we're going to deal with servicing the originals if anyone wants them. We do have a portable hard drive of the digitized files, and our law and legislative unit is providing access to those. So hopefully now that it's over, interest won't be that great, and maybe by the time it surfaces, we will have figured out how to deal with these records in some more organized way. John Rowland pled guilty in federal court to one count of corruption and served his time in a prison in western Pennsylvania. He was sentenced to 1 year and one day, but he actually served less time than that. So he was actually in prison for less than a year. But he was in prison at the same time that Mayor Gannon was in prison, but they were in different places. When he left prison, he returned to his home in West Hartford. He originally is from Waterbury, and we could have a whole day on discussing politics in Waterbury, Connecticut. But he relocated to West Hartford to be with his family. And, you know, everyone has to reinvent themselves, and that's what John Rowland is attempting to do. He's signed up with a motivational speakers bureau. No, he's not speaking about crime pays, because, of course, in his case, it didn't. But what he is doing is he is lecturing on the fact that crime doesn't pay, And he's already got one contract, and he gave a talk to a group of female teenage athletes on abuse of power with the intention of persuading them not to follow his example. Before Roland went to prison, he called the state librarian to ask about the fate of the records of his terms. I guess everyone is interested in their legacy. The state librarian told him that they were in the state archives. To paraphrase the former governor, he replied that this was good. I would rather that they be in the state library instead of in others' hands. We do not know how the Song of Roland will end, but it is consolation to have his blessings. Thank you. And now, our next speaker will be Betsy Pittman.
Thank you all for coming. And just a quick note to follow up from Eunice's talk on John Roland. We're the other, by the way. I don't know if he meant that intentionally or not, but as you will see, we're clearly identified. One caveat in explaining my title, Negotiating the Restricted Collection, is I have the great luxury, and I will revel in it for the short period that I might have it, of talking about collections that I inherited. They were already there when I got there. The negotiations had already taken place, and I just have the great pleasure, duty, and frustration of working with the restrictions that I inherited. So that's what I agreed to talk about today. In the decade of its existence, the Thomas J. Dodd Research Center on the University of Connecticut Storrs campus has acquired the personal papers of many of Connecticut's 20th century congressional delegation. Of specific interest for this presentation are the papers of John G. Roland, and through a transfer from the Connecticut State Library, those of Senator Thomas J. Dodd. Of all the political collections we house, only these two collections have restrictions. I plan to address the constraints and concerns these restrictions have imposed and why the negotiations during the donation process is so necessary for access and reference for what could be considered sensitive materials. Please bear in mind that these are the personal papers, but they are held in a public institution. And we must utilize the existing deeds as examples of the spectrum of restrictions that have been presented to us when working with personal papers. And I'm sorry, I will have to bore you with a little background. The congressional collections housed in the Dodd Research Center document the varied careers of those who constitute Connecticut's congressional delegation throughout most of the 20th century. Although we do not have the papers of all, the records we do have provide researchers with a broad and varied spectrum of materials that document the changing political, economic, and social environment of 20th century Connecticut, New England, and the United States. There are currently over 20 collections, totaling over 1,000 linear feet of records. The collections include the papers of Senators Francis T. Maloney, Thomas J. Dodd, and Prescott Bush. Representatives Robert Giamo, Bruce Morrison, William Ratchford, Barbara Kennelly, William Cotter, Stuart McKinney, and Sam Gaidenson. Future collecting areas include a focus on U.S. senators from Connecticut and women representing Connecticut at the national level. Representatives of the Mansfield, Connecticut area in the state at and national level may also be considered for inclusion, but again, those are subject to negotiation. Also included in this broad area of interest are the papers of Connecticut civic leaders and politically oriented support organizations. We will consider acquiring the papers or records of similar organizations covering the wide spectrum of political orientation or concerns throughout the state. And for those of you who are interested in either the Dodd Center or the political collections, there's a pile of brochures. Please help yourself. The political collections brochure is brand new, so never seen before. We're rather pleased with it. The Thomas J. Dodd Research Center is a unit of the University of Connecticut Libraries located on the store's campus, which is located in Mansfield, Connecticut. As a state institution, we are open to the public. The mission of the Dodd Center is to support the University of Connecticut's mission of teaching, research, and service. It acquires, preserves, and makes accessible specialized research collections for students, faculty, staff, scholars, and the general public, and supports the development and promotion of public programs, exhibitions, conferences, and similar events to enhance the university's teaching and research activities. I'm sure that sounds very familiar for those of you in college and university environments. This mission, in conjunction with our own professional standards, provides a strong foundation and belief in open access and availability to all who request materials in the collections we administer. However, this foundation is balanced against any donor concerns over personal privacy. To the extent that each curator works with donors to ensure that any materials to be considered for restriction are limited in quantity, the restrictions are reasonable, and they are as of short duration as possible. It has been useful when working with donors and patrons to refer questions and concerns as to why we want these particular qualities in our restrictions, to refer them to the SAA Code of Ethics, for which I thank whoever worked on them. The Dodd Research Center prefers collections that have no restrictions, but as you are all aware, sometimes it is necessary. The center has very infrequently imposed restrictions on specific items in unrestricted collections, but they tend to be matters of personal privacy of third parties who probably have no idea that their materials have ended up in institutions that offer materials for public research or for security, and they have a limited impact on the collection as a whole. If anyone has questions about specifics in these areas, I'd be more than happy to answer questions, but they really don't pertain to the political collections. I'd like to present two examples from the political collections with restrictions and the problems that both of them have presented. As you've heard, John Rowland was a former governor, but prior to that, he was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 1985 from the 5th District of Connecticut and served in that position until 1991. Prior to that, he had served in the Connecticut General Assembly from 1981 to 1984. And you've had a very good education in his career as governor. Thomas J. Dodd was elected to Congress from the 1st Congressional District in 1952 and was reelected 2 years later. He was the only Connecticut Democrat to sit in the U.S. House during this time period. After unsuccessfully running for the U.S. Senate in 1956 against Republican incumbent Prescott Bush, Dodd ran again and defeated Republican William A. Purtell in 1958. As a result of a vote for censure prior to his running for a later term, in 1970, Dodd withdrew his name from consideration by the Democratic State Convention after learning he would not be renominated by the party. He proceeded to mount an unsuccessful independent campaign and retired following his defeat by Lowell Weicker. So that was my background. My first description highlights what is the ultimate in collection restrictions, as far as I'm concerned, short of not getting the collection at all. I mean, put that aside. John Rowland's congressional papers were donated in 1991 and placed under a complete restriction for 5 years. In 1996, this was extended to 1998. In 1999, he again, by way of his legal counsel, extended the restriction for another 4 years. As you've heard, things kind of declined rather rapidly and got very excited for that time period as this restriction was coming to a close. And it kind of slipped my mind to write again and ask, could we please start working on this collection? This has since been corrected, and another request has gone forward. And hopefully now that he is no longer a sitting governor and probably will not be running for election in any office anytime soon, we will get permission to open the papers. To date, the boxes have never been touched, and all requests to continue the restrictions but allow for processing so that the collection could be made available once those restrictions were listed or had expired have been denied. I can't even take the tape off the boxes. A situation, as you can imagine, is extremely frustrating. I have no knowledge of the contents, the strengths, the scope of the collection. The restrictions will also add more time for processing when they have finally been completed. This prompted my question a few days ago when we had a presentation at the Library of Congress when dealing with 20th century political collections to ask, what are their restrictions and do they ever negotiate for this type of arrangement? I was very pleased to hear that I'm not alone and that they do not allow this type of restriction. So there's hope. Thomas J. Dodd's congressional papers were originally deposited in the Connecticut State Library in 1972 by Mrs. Dodd. In 1994, the collection was transferred to the University of Connecticut and housed in the Dodd Research Center. Deeds of gift were signed by Senator Dodd's heirs and transferred the property right of the collection to the university upon receipt, with the understanding that the materials, and I quote, be made available for research as soon as possible, end of quote. The materials, however, did come with three restrictions. Materials that are specifically authorized under criteria established by statute or executive order to be kept secret in the interest of national defense or foreign policy and are in fact properly classified pursuant to such statute or executive order, these materials are to be restricted until declassified. Perfectly understandable, very reasonable. Materials relating to the confidential, personal, or business affairs of Senator Thomas J. Dodd or members of his family are restricted until October 2013, at which time the archivist, now myself, shall refer those review those materials to determine if any of them fall within this category still merit being restricted. After review and consultation with the remaining heirs, the final decision still rests with me as to whether the restriction stays or not. Materials relating to the investigation of individuals, organizations, to proposed appointments to office, or to other personal matters affecting individual privacy is the third restriction. These materials are restricted for 50 years from the date of creation. Unlike the Rowland papers, the portion of the Dodd papers affected by these constraints are very limited in nature and have clear-cut guidelines and end dates. Needless to say, if you are going to inherit restrictions, this is the situation to inherit. The understanding of the family of the wider interest in research potential in the collection as a whole is gratifying. I'm very pleased to report that the collection is one of the most heavily used and has been available for research since 1996. To sum up, I'd like to share with you my recommendations, having worked with these two collections, of what I would like to be able to negotiate when working with political collections. First, a clear understanding of what is being restricted and why. The archives should not be evaluating materials against vague criteria without clear-cut explanations. Repositories can run the risk of even a perception of censorship, partisanship, and unequal access, things that we don't encourage at the very least. Let's put it that way. Restrictions should be lifted by date, not a condition. And this goes for all collections, not just political collections. It really is very difficult to track when people die, move, reach a certain age, or change political party, residence, whatever the condition might be. Dates are fairly concrete, easy to mark, easy to track. I'm looking for clarity and specific instructions. The restrictions should be proportionate to the size of the collection and very limited if they must be imposed at all. Just as a case in point, the Dodd papers are somewhere between 200 and 300 linear feet of materials. The restricted materials encompass maybe a tenth of that, maybe. Rowland, however, it's 100%. It's very hard to work with that type of restriction. And if at all possible, if you must restrict vast quantities of the collection, please try to get your donor, their family, their heirs, the trustee, whoever you're working with, to understand that you are a professional, you do follow guidelines, and you do know how to keep your mouth shut and allow you to work in the collection while they are still restricted, which means that you are no longer adding the processing time, which all of you are very well aware of when you're dealing with political collections. They tend to be very, very large. So you're adding, in the most case, a minimum of several years before they can really be made available for research. We do not restrict unprocessed collections from research per se, but if they, we will publicize them, we will make them available, but we will require that appointments be made, we will provide assistance, but political collections can be very, very complicated, particularly if the office had to pack up in a hurry, at the very least. And I can tell you a story about that one, too, if you wish. So if you can negotiate to have access at least to that minimal level where you can go through it and even do a rough inventory, it will assist you in the long run. I mean, it would be nice if you could be able to fully process the entire collection so as soon as that date passes, surprise, brand new collection ready for research. You're trying to achieve a balance, at the very least, of allowing for personal privacy. Again, these are personal collections. These are not public records. There's no statutory mandate that says that they must be made available, although they are discoverable, as is just about everything else. But there is a balance that can be achieved when working with these records. And when it comes down to it, the final say really rests with you. Evaluate. Is it worth the time, the shelving, the frustration of dealing with these materials when you cannot make them accessible within a reasonable period of time? For those who are contemplating working with their current delegation who may be thinking about leaving office or retiring, I do recommend working with the, in our particular case, we've worked with the Senate History Office. They've been very helpful in providing the administrative staff of the members and senators with guidelines for both the deeds of gift, potential restrictions, and they're on our side. They really want things to be open and available. And with that, I will open the floor for questions. Please bear in mind that this is being recorded, so if you could step to the microphone in the center of the room if you have questions so that we can all hear you and they can be recorded. Thank you.
Do we have any questions? Very well. I guess we covered the topic. Then thank you very much.